This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, there is trouble once again in the Balkans, and most people will remember the horrors of the war that broke out there, the civil war essentially, a war that followed the breakup of the old Yugoslavia and, of course, was part of the collapse of the old Soviet Union. And now there is trouble again between the Serbs and the people of Kosovo. It's a very complicated situation, and we're joined to discuss it now by Ian Williams, an author and journalist. Ian was a foreign correspondent for Channel 4 News and NBC. He covered Russia, Asia. He also covered that conflict in the Balkans, and he won an Emmy and BAFTA awards for his discovery and reporting on the Serb detention camps during the war in Bosnia. His most recent book, The Fire of the Dragon, China's New Cold War, is on the shortlist at the moment for the Orwell Prize for Political Writing. Ian, thank you very much for joining us today. We want to talk to you, obviously, about the Balkans and about this trouble that's rearing its ugly head. I note that the tennis player Djokovic describes Kosovo as the heart of Serbia, but that's not the way the people of Kosovo view it, is it?
It isn't, and there are so many ghosts in the Balkans, which NATO and Western democracies are keen to leave that way, and that they're very worried about these old conflicts, not-so-old conflicts, flaring up again, especially at a time when Russia is in mischievous-making mode.
Yes.
It's very worrying, the developments that have taken place in Kosovo over recent weeks, but at the same time, not so surprising given the real underlying tensions that are there. I covered the NATO intervention in Kosovo in 1999 when they were welcomed there in order to head off what was becoming a very ugly civil war and the quite severe repression by the Yugoslav government, Serb-dominated Yugoslav government at the time, against the ethnic Albanian majority in Kosovo. The Serbs, as you've mentioned with Djokovic, have always regarded Kosovo as a part of the cradle of Serbian civilization because of various historic events and places which are important to the Serbs. But of course, contemporary Kosovo is overwhelmingly Albanian and overwhelmingly independent. Well, they are legally independent in the eyes of most Western countries, but not recognized as such by Serbia and the Russians.
Yes, I have a friend who played soccer in the United States, and he played in a team that had both Croats and Serbs in it. And he said the hatred between them was palpable and very evident and never likely to melt, even though they were on the same football team, which is really quite unusual.
Yeah, the animosities, the hatreds, historic and contemporary, run very, very deep. And sometimes it's hard for an outsider to appreciate just how profound some of those, that distrust, that hatred has become. And I think that the NATO force in Kosovo, Western democracies who've been trying to coax Serbia into recognizing Kosovan independence, have been very worried about the possibility of flare-ups there and very concerned about a potential Russian hand behind it at a time when NATO and the West is preoccupied with the intervention in Ukraine. Part of the problem, I think, is Albin Kurti, who is in charge in Kosovo. They held elections in Serb-dominated areas of northern Kosovo, which were boycotted by the local Serb populations, which meant that ethnic Albanian mayors were elected to those areas. And he, against the advice of NATO, insisted on imposing those mayors on those local areas, which then, of course, resulted in rioting and the sort of violent scenes that we saw. You know, in many respects, it's easy to dismiss this as being a rather trivial incident. But as you point out, the animosities run so deep and the potential for a bigger flare-up is so profound that NATO and the EU and Western democracies in general have been very concerned about where this might lead. You know, for a long time, they've been courting President Vucic of Serbia to try and draw him away from the Russian orbit and away from his good friend Vladimir Putin, holding out the prospect of EU membership, holding out the prospect of closer economic cooperation. And that had appeared to be succeeding to some extent. And this whole flare-up has somewhat undermined that and, you know, created a lot of concern about where this might lead. And there's a lot of efforts being put in desperately to try and defuse it.
Yes, and this will remind us, as Slobodan Milosevic in 1998 was Serb leader. He was found to be responsible, or that conflict was, for about 13,000 deaths. He was charged with war crimes in The Hague and found guilty.
That's right. And of course, Vucic, who's now the president of Serbia, was his information minister for quite some time. And it was, of course, Milosevic who jailed Albin Kurti, who is the head now of Kosovo. So there are a lot of overlapping links there and a lot of raw memories and raw animosities. And the sheer numbers, the atrocities that were committed, the violence, the hatred that we saw during that period of mass upheaval in the Balkans is not something which we'd want to see repeated. But of course, it would be scarily convenient for Russia if this was to blow up create another front, another area of difficulty for NATO, which, don't forget, does have troops in Kosovo, and another preoccupation for the EU and the United States.
Yes, and we know something about historic enmities in this country, Ian, but reading a piece I think you wrote, it reminds us that Serbian nationalists still view their 1389 battle with the Ottoman Turks as symbolic of their struggle. So they have long memories.
They do. And, you know, Kosovo figures very highly in those memories, as you point out. I think that Albin Kurti has tried to put what's happening in northern Kosovo in the context of sort of Ukraine and the Russian, ethnic Russian areas. But I'm not sure that fits quite as comfortably. And in fact, the Northern Irish situation, some argue, is a more accurate description of what we're seeing in Kosovo.
Yes. Now, it's overshadowed by the conflict between Russia and Ukraine at this moment, and it's not commanding the attention, but it does have, or does it have the capacity to revert back to where we were?
I think it does, because the tensions have been simmering there for so long. It is a very dangerous place. It's you never quite know what it might take, and it might be something quite trivial for things to flare up. I don't think people quite expected the reaction that there was just the other day as a result of these mayors looking to take up their positions. I mean, you know, on paper you look at it and you think, well, five mayors, this is trivial, but nothing really is trivial in the context of those deep-rooted animosities and hatreds even that still exist in the Balkans, and where you have the key players in Serbia, in Kosovo, related in, as they are to events of just a few years ago, and in a scary way, really.
Yeah, as I say, it's all overshadowed by what's happening with the Ukraine and the Russians, and also because in Britain, for example, they have problems of their own. That's not to say that it's something we shouldn't be aware of and concerned about.
I think that we can be pretty sure there are some frantic negotiations, some frantic contacts going on behind the scenes. And there is, I think, a profound awareness in Brussels, in London, in Washington, that this does have the capacity to upend a lot of deliberate, cautious work that's gone on in Serbia and in Kosovo over recent years to try and diffuse these tensions in the knowledge that Russia would like to see nothing more than a violent flare-up, and during which it could demonstrate its solidarity with its Serbian brethren.
The Serbians are dominant force, I take it. Do they have an interest in the European Union, which confers benefits as well as demanding certain disciplines?
They do, and they are a candidate for EU membership. EU membership would be enormously beneficial to Serbia. And as with many other countries, Brussels has held out the prospect of eventual membership as a way both of encouraging economic reform in Serbia, but also political reform, and using it as a way to try and blunt extremism with the message that, you know, if Serbia behaves, if Serbia reassesses its view of Kosovan independence, which is an ultimate aim, then the prospect of membership of the EU is very real.
Yes. I mean, that stick and carrot approach has worked up to a point, although we can see now in, say, Poland or indeed in Hungary that it maybe has its limits to some extent.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
There's another piece you wrote for The Spectator, Ian, recently, which I really enjoyed, and I think our listeners would enjoy. It's about stand-up comedians in China and the sort of growth of comedy in China, which is, and now it's being attacked by Xi Jinping, who you describe as exceptionally humorless, even by the standards of recent Chinese leaders. And you quote a dissident artist, Ai Weiwei, who says the Chinese Communist Party is probably the funniest thing that exists, but it doesn't have a sense of humor. Tell me about the threat to the Chinese state that these comedians are posing.
Well, I think that ridicule and humor have always been very potent weapons against tyranny.
Yes.
And Ai Weiwei was a big advocate of that in his art. When I first met him, he'd recently been under house arrest, and they put 25 surveillance cameras around his house to watch his movements. And he responded by putting another 4 or 5 inside his house, in some of the most intimate corners of his house. And he said, well, this is just in case they miss something. And he broadcast this live, an online feed to the internet. And it was watched about 5 million times over the 24 hours until the party closed it down, ordered him to take down the cameras. But he'd made his point that, you know, that the party was quite happy to put him under surveillance, but didn't want him to surveil himself. And to him, that was just another measure of the sheer yes. absurdity of their repression. But the case, the most recent case, was that of a 31-year-old stand-up comedian called Li Haoshu, who, in a packed show in Beijing, mocked a slogan that Xi Jinping had used to describe the military when he'd said, "Forge exemplary conduct, fight to win." And Li said this rather reminded him of his two dogs chasing a squirrel. Cue outrage, the municipal authorities accusing him of wantonly slandering the glorious image of the PLA and claiming his joke would have a vile societal impact.
And the Tourism Bureau said that it wouldn't allow him to wantonly slander the glorious image
absolutely.
Of the People's Liberation Army.
Yeah, and
it's a very potent way of exposing them, isn't it?
It is, and he was immediately banned. I mean, there were rumors he'd been arrested. I'm not sure whether he has yet, but he's being investigated under a law against criticizing the army, which could land him in jail for several years. He's had his earnings confiscated. He's been banned from performing. And you know, it does show the potency of humor and what a thin skin the party has. But I think a lot of people would be quite surprised to hear that China has a stand-up comedy scene at all, given
yes,
the constraints.
Yeah.
Because when you think about it, Eamon, stand-up comedy is by definition political. You do tend to
yes.
Point fun at the authorities, at the government. I mean, I well remember a few years ago in Beijing meeting a Chinese comic who was self-taught in New York, where he'd studied, and he'd loved the stand-up comedy scene. He'd come back to China, and he was complaining that no one was laughing. And I'd met him, and I said, well, I assume this was because of the nature of political jokes, that he had to be so cautious in China. And we sat there over a beer near Lake, the Hohai Lake, and he shook his head and he said, no. He said, it's just that modern China is beyond parody.
Yes, and I note that you write about the state media reporting that a 34-year-old woman had been detained for posting online support for Lee, who is a popular British-Malaysian stand-up comedian who goes by the name of Uncle Roger. He had his Chinese social media account suspended for violation of relevant law and regulations. It is, on the one hand, it's surreal, but on the other, it shows you the depths and the horror of totalitarianism.
Yeah, and the sheer paranoia. I mean, they're the only ones, they're the ones we know about. And yes, then there was this whole wave of cancellation of cultural events and similar festivals. They included a What the Folkstival festival, which was supposed to have 10 live acts to play acoustic music to soothe your soul. And there was another performance by a Japanese Buddhism influence group and a Ladies Who Tech convention. I mean, those who were involved in those believe it was connected to the comedian, to Lee. But in what way? You look at it and the only thing they have in common is, yes, they're sort of vaguely Western influenced. Yes, they're fun. Perhaps there is some capacity there for irreverence. Maybe it's local officials being over enthusiastic to follow the lead of the party, lashing out and banning anything that might smack of irreverence. But it is truly extraordinary.
Yes, and there was a female stand-up comedian that you write about called Yang Li. She was also known, you point out, as the punchline queen. And she faced sanctions. She faced sanctions after being accused of insulting men during one of her shows.
That's right. Well, don't forget, China is run by men, mainly elderly men,
yes.
Who have targeted, among other things, the Me Too movement. And so it's not altogether surprising that you have somebody whose humor is or has been directed towards the chauvinism of Chinese society, then finding herself sanctioned for criticizing men. I mean, there are other comics as well who've been criticized for vulgar content, but, you know, amazingly enough, the number of clubs, I was surprised when I researched the article, they've gone from just a handful 6-7 years ago, mainly Shanghai, Beijing, to almost 200 now. So these comedy clubs have proliferated. And I think it was, there was a show as well, which I mentioned there, Rock and Roast, which nurtured a lot of stand-up comedians. And it was very successful, especially during the pandemic when people were stuck at home and the humor was dark, you know, poking fun at Chinese life. And, you know, it does show it. It is a, you know, we do talk about the power of humor against totalitarian systems, and the response in China against these comics is testament to that.
Yes, and as you point out, she is exceptionally humorless, even by the standards of recent Chinese.
He is, you know, he's a particularly dour individual.
Yeah, and Mao apparently also of that ilk, who they believe that art, as you write, is an instrument of politics and that entertainers should be role models spouting bland Communist Party homilies. I want to ask you something about now, Ian, and it's about the American Chief of Staff, Lloyd Austin. He's the U.S. Defense Secretary. He was in Singapore recently, and he called for a bilateral meeting with China. I also note a piece I read in the Financial Times this week that a senior figure from the CIA had visited China secretly to have meetings with his counterpart in Beijing to talk about the relationship, which is, on the face of it at the moment, extremely strained.
Very, and this was the Singapore Dialogue, the Shangri-La Dialogue, an annual event in the in that city state, bringing together the good and the great of the security and defense world. I mean, the Chinese counterpart, Li Xiangfu, was appointed as defense minister just in March this year. That was a bit awkward because he was a former general in the PLA and he's been under U.S. sanctions since 2018. That was related to arms purchases from Russia. And so there were demands that those sanctions be lifted, but I don't think they have been. Have been big efforts on the US side to try and put what they call guardrails in place to set up a security hotline, for instance, yes, and other sort of relationships to avoid misunderstandings. And of course, the dangers were in evidence in the Taiwan Strait just earlier this week when a Chinese warship cut across an American and Canadian warships, which were conducting a freedom of navigation exercise in the Taiwan Strait, with lots of accusations of the amount of danger and the danger of escalation. But it was noted that, I mean, I just looking at his words here in Singapore, Li Xiangfu quoting the lyrics from an old Chinese song saying, "When friends visit us, we welcome them with fine wine. When jackals or wolves come, we face them with shotguns."
Yes.
And this is a guy who is accusing America of having a Cold War mentality.
Yes.
He should know.
He should indeed. Finally, Ian, the question of the U.S. relationship with China, and of course it's Taiwan is a much more serious matter. I wonder if you'd agree that Taiwan is a much more serious matter because it would bring conflict between China and the United States of America, and that would be compared to what's happening in Ukraine, that would be a serious big boy stuff. It is said that Xi Jinping has told Putin and Lavrov, who have been talking about the use of nuclear weapons, that nobody wins in nuclear conflict. Don't go there. From your own observations of that, of China, that is somewhat reassuring in terms of the bad relationship at the moment between the US and China.
It is, but it's also worth noting that there are no talks between China and the US at all on nuclear issues and arms control. Again, yes, it's something which China has long resisted. There's a very different view to arms control, nuclear discussions, guardrails, hotlines, call them what you will. The US has always taken the view that these are important structures to have in place, irrespective of the rest of the relationship. Whereas China has taken the view that they are inseparable from the rest of the relationship and has not wanted to go down the road of establishing these structures unless the US is prepared to discuss a whole pile of other things in their relationship. But on the nuclear front, China makes these noises, but is at the same time involved in a massive buildup of nuclear weapons. And also, I think China will have noted that one of the reasons why, of course, NATO is avoiding a direct involvement in the Ukraine war is because of the danger of escalation. And
yes,
Russia has taken a sort of madman approach to its nuclear weapons. Whereas in the Cold War, yes, the nukes were always there, but their use was more implicit. They were in the background. You didn't often see them brandished openly with threats. Whereas what's happened in Ukraine is that Russia has regularly brandished its nuclear threat, has regularly hinted openly or more less openly that these weapons are there and they could at some point be used. And so the nuclear threat has been made much more explicit. And I think, yes, you could argue that China has been worried by that. And yes, there are reports that it has passed those concerns on to Russia. But it will also have noted that by brandishing its nuclear weapons so provocatively, NATO has perhaps been a little bit more cautious than it might otherwise have been.
Right. And it's a final question, Ian, if you'll forgive me. The imperative of Taiwan, how profound is it to Xi Jinping, to China, to the Chinese Communist Party?
It's very profound. It was the elephant in the room in Singapore.
Yes.
It is central to Xi Jinping's idea of national rejuvenation, his China dream. The big difference from previous Chinese leaders is arguably Xi now has the capacity to do what was only sort of more of a dream in the eyes, yes, of earlier Chinese leaders. He has shown himself prepared to intimidate militarily at a level that we have not seen before. And arguably, China is already waging a form of grey warfare, yes, against the island of Taiwan. And I think that on the other side, Taiwan has become much, much more important in the eyes of the United States, but not just the US, also in the eyes of her allies, particularly Japan.
Yes.
Because of the strategic importance of the island in itself, because of the democratic status of the island. All of these together mean that both morally and strategically, Taiwan has taken on a far greater significance for the West at a time when it's become so central to Xi Jinping's idea of a rejuvenation of the great Chinese nation.
Okay, Ian, we're very grateful to you indeed for talking to us today. Ian Williams is a writer and a journalist and indeed a broadcaster, and we're very grateful to him for joining us today. We're grateful to all of you for listening. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.